You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. You're fired. Donald Trump became famous bellowing those words in a make-believe boardroom. This November, tens of millions of Americans want to yell it right back at him. Yet somehow, Trump has seemed to almost defy the laws of political physics. Now Paul Bagala, one of America's greatest political talents, lays out the strategy that will defeat him and send him back to Mar-a-Lago in his new book titled You're Fired, The Perfect Guide to Beating Donald Trump. And today, Paul joins me on the podcast to talk about it. He starts by admitting what he didn't understand about Donald Trump in 2016 and shares what lessons learned in 2016 can be applied to 2020. Contrary to Donald Trump's claims, Paul tells the story of how the Obama White House warned the incoming Trump administration about the threat of a global pandemic almost 4 years ago, and he outlines the best way for Joe Biden to address Trump's mishandling of the COVID crisis. He reveals his plan for expanding voting rights while still protecting election integrity, which Trump voters can be won back in 2020, and two big issues that may plague Democrats long after Trump is gone. Plus the time Paul lost an election to a cartoon character, and why he says it's still the economy, stupid. Coming up with Paul Bagala in just a moment. Paul Bagala was a chief strategist for the 1992 Clinton-Gore campaign. He then served as counselor to the president in the Clinton White House, where he coordinated policy, politics, and communications. He was a senior advisor to the pro-Obama super PAC that played a critical role in re-electing Obama in 2012. And currently, Bagala is a CNN political commentator and an affiliate professor of public policy at Georgetown University's McCourt School of Public Policy. He's also the author of 6 books, including his latest, You're Fired, The Perfect Guide to Beating Donald Trump. Paul Bagala, welcome to the podcast.
Ben, thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Well, Paul, I have to tell you, I am impressed. On the back cover of your book, you have reviews from 2 U.S. presidents. You have Bill Clinton, who says, quote, Bagala's book is heartbreaking, hilarious, hopeful, and helpful. It's wise, profoundly patriotic, and deeply moral. Read it. And then President Donald Trump says, Paul Bagala, the dopey CNN flunky and head of the pro-Hillary Clinton super PAC, has knowingly committed fraud in his first ad against me. Do you find it weirdly validating to be the subject of a Trump tweet? Is that a sign that you think you're on the right track, you're doing something right?
That's exactly right, Ben. I wear it as a badge of honor. Of course, every ad we ran was true and factual, I am kind of dopey at times. I don't know that I'm a flunky, but I'm some of it had a ring of truth.
Yeah, and I was also surprised to see that you have a rave review from, of all people, Willie Nelson, who I think said here, if you want to know what's going on, read this book. How'd that happen? Are you friends with Willie?
I don't want to overstate. I know him. It's an Austin thing. I'm from Texas. Oh, I've been a fan of his forever, and I've met him several times, and he and his wife, Annie, are terrific progressive activists in Texas and around the country. But I sent it to him because I worked very hard on the whole book, but I worked very hard on a chapter about rural America and how to drive a pickup truck between Trump and his voters. And I asked Willie to read it before I sent it to the publisher because he, in addition to being a legendary singer and really a national treasure, Willie has been the most effective and dogged advocate for family farmers in this country for four decades. He started Farm Aid, and he's still deeply knowledgeable about farm policy and farm families. And so I really wanted him. I cared desperately what he thought about it. He thought it was pretty good. So he gave me a nice endorsement of the book, which is terribly, terribly kind of him.
Yeah, yeah, that's a great review. I love him. I've been listening to him since I was a kid. And he's one of those people I'm still dying to get on the podcast. We haven't gotten him yet, but one of these days, I guess.
Oh, you need to. Okay, we'll work on that, man.
Well, speaking of Texans, Paul, you and I actually have something in common. We grew up practically neighbors. I am originally from Richmond, Texas, and I guess you were raised right across the Brazos there in Missouri City, Sugarland area, huh?
So were you Lamar Consolidated boy?
Exactly, the Mustangs, yep.
I know the high school well, yeah. We were rival schools on the other side, the east side of the river, at John Foster Dulles High School in Sugarland.
Yeah.
That's amazing. I did not know that.
Yeah, yeah, it's a small world. I mean, you know, when I say that I'm from Richmond, they think Richmond, Virginia. No, I don't think I've ever met anyone who was that familiar with Richmond, Texas, unless they came from Texas.
Well, if I could, a quick bit of history from our home county that I did not know until the last few weeks. You know, with the consciousness raising of the woke factor of Black Lives Matter, a guy back in Sugar Land named Terrell Patel, who went to University of Texas after me, but I know him, who's also from Fort Bend County. He found out that in Richmond, at our courthouse, at the Fort Bend County Courthouse, there is a statue celebrating and commemorating the Jaybirds, who were the most racist. They literally fought a war. It's a Jaybird War in 1889 against the pro-Reconstruction African-Americans and whites who were progressive. They actually shot each other. They had a physical war, and our county celebrates the races.
Yes.
So Terrell got the county to cover, the statue's covered up now.
Oh, and really?
I think gonna move it. So there is progress even in Fort Bend County, which by the way, I think Joe Biden's gonna win Fort Bend County.
Oh, no kidding. Well, yeah, I mean, with all the development in Sugar Land and Missouri City and the areas where you were, I can see that there would be a lot of Democratic voters ripe for the picking there. Yeah, definitely.
Our home county, and imagine this, is now the 10th largest in Texas. It was small when I was a kid. But interestingly, it's majority non-white, full of immigrants, flooded with immigrants. Mm-hmm. And those immigrants have taken our little county from being a rural backwater to being the wealthiest county in Texas. So this whole notion, Stephen Miller and Donald Trump say, immigrants are bad immigrants. Those immigrants made our home county the wealthiest county in Texas, which is one of the wealthiest states in America.
Wow. Yeah, so that I did not know.
God bless them. Hamilton was right. Immigrants get it done.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you know, it's hard to imagine that, you know, just a few years back, it was Tom DeLay's district.
But, right. Well, now I there's a guy running for Congress in DeLay's old district, who I've campaigned for, Sri Preston Kulkarni. Hmm. And Sri ran the last time and lost narrowly. Sri, his dad came to Fort Bend County from India seeking the American dream. Sri was born in the district. And speaks seven or eight languages, was in the foreign service working for our country all around the world. He's an amazing guy. So he ran the last time. Pete Olson, the Republican congressman who's retiring, attacked him. He called him an Indo-American carpetbagger.
Oh, wow.
So Sri's answer was twofold. Well, by the way, he was born in the district. Congressman Olson was not. But he pointed out that he was proud that his father came to Fort Bend County seeking the American dream and came to Texas seeking the American dream. He said, you know, my mother's side of the family, they came to Texas seeking the American dream as well. But they came earlier. Her great-great-great-grandfather was a guy named Sam Houston.
Huh. Wow.
So this guy is a direct descendant of Sam Houston and the son of an Indian immigrant seeking the American dream. That's Fort Bend County today, man. That's our home. And I'm so proud of him. He's going to win.
That
He's
is
a
the
Democratic
American dream.
Congressman.
Wow. Now, you also went to school at the University of Texas. And in fact, I think that I heard that your first political campaign was when you ran for student body president at UT. And there's a kind of a crazy story. I don't know if this is true. You initially lost to a cartoon character. Is that true?
It's true. A great cartoonist named Sam Hurt created this character, Hank the Hallucination. And they had abolished student government. And so we brought it back. because they were spending millions of dollars of our money, the administration was, without students' influence, taxation without representation. So we recreated, resurrected student government, and Hank ran as a write-in candidate, Sam Hurt's cartoon character, the hallucination, and his slogan was "Get Real." Well, Hank won, and of course the student quarter, whatever, decided that a cartoon character couldn't serve. So they had a runoff against the two top humans. I won that. But that lesson, get real, has stuck with me. So here's what we did. The students understandably didn't want student government. Then they brought it back. We had to get real. So I started a group, still active, called SURE, Students United for Rape Elimination. This is 37 years ago. But then and now, rape is a horrible problem, and particularly on campuses. So we started an organization, by the way, still supported today by Matthew McConaughey and others. It's a terrific group at Texas that I'm proud to have started. My now wife, then girlfriend, started the recycling program on campus. She also started a childcare center for students who have babies, which is still there. So we did things that affected people's lives. We got real. Instead of just making it a debating society or a resume pad, we actually delivered on things that mattered in kids' lives. Wow. We defeated a tuition increase in the legislature. We also defeated a move to raise the drinking age of 21. So that taught me a lot about government. It really did, is that you have to get real. You have to be in people's real lives and make a real effect. If you're just in it to honk off and try to bolster your resume, you're going to fail the people who are counting on you. So actually, the Hank experience and losing to a cartoon character was a wonderful lesson for me.
Yeah, I wonder, do you think that losing to a cartoon character sort of presaged the 2016 election?
Yes, because I forgot the lesson. People projected onto Hank whatever they wanted. People projected onto Mr. Trump whatever it is they wanted. Huh. And you know, that's a powerful inclination that we have. And I say this in the book, it's the first chapter, it's called Mea Culpa, what I got wrong. One of the things I got wrong is I didn't really appreciate how many people just wanted a wrecking ball and were willing to set aside their disdain for his character. Most Trump voters are not racist, okay? They're just not. There's racism in America. We know from where we grew up. But it's the fallacy of composition. All the racists are Trump supporters, but not all the Trump supporters are racist. Like, all giraffes are animals, but not all animals are giraffes. So I really think that it's important to understand why good people voted for a bad man. And I wrestle with that in the book.
Yeah, and I think that you said that your brother in Texas was the one who opened your eyes to this, huh? What happened in that election?
He did. My brother Dave, I have a great many brothers, but Dave is my big brother and smart as hell and a very successful businessman in construction and not overly political. But he saw that. He said to me after the election, you know, I guess I shouldn't say how he voted, but he voted for Hillary. And yet he understood that people, they liked the entertainment factor from Trump. They liked the spectacle. They liked the showbiz talent, of which he has terrific performance skills. He really does. And I didn't show people why, despite those skills and the talent and the entertainment value, he was really going to hurt you. And I didn't make that connection. And his line to me was, when Hillary got something wrong, people said, well, she's an effing liar because she's a politician. And when Trump got 10,000 things wrong, they said, well, he's just a bullshit artist.
So it was expected.
Right.
Interesting.
And in fact, all the fact checkers said of the 20-something candidates who ran for president in both parties, Hillary told the truth more often than anyone. She was actually the most honest person running for president in 2016. Trump, of course, is the biggest, fattest liar who ever lived.
Well, you know, you do a deep analysis of what went wrong more broadly for Democrats in 2016. Walk us through the areas where the Clinton campaign and the Democratic establishment failed or misfired or whatever you want to call it.
Well, it's more important morally for me to say what I got wrong.
Okay.
You know, I think Hillary still got more votes. She still should be president.
Right.
She, I think, persevered amazingly against Russian interference, against James Comey, who ultimately did flip the election to Mr. Trump. So I have no criticism of Hillary, but I have criticism of me. Here's what Begala got wrong. It's like, you know, that Billy Crystal movie, City Slickers?
Yeah, of course.
Jack Palance is going to tell him the secret of life. And I don't mean to, spoiler alert, but here's Jack Palance, the secret of life. He's got that black glove in his hand. And he says, the main thing is always keep the main thing the main thing. Well, I forgot the main thing. The main thing is that we're all in this to make people's lives better, right? There are still kids at UT who have children who could go to put them in childcare safely because of my wife, right? That's real. And that's contributing to people's lives. And it really doesn't matter to their life very much if Trump says something outrageous or even racist, or even if he boasts about grabbing women.
Interesting.
You know, he's not going to grab the farmer in Wisconsin or the steelworker in Pennsylvania or the office worker in Michigan. You know, so I think I got that wrong. I think I didn't connect it up to people's lives enough. I was too distracted by this monstrous personal character of Trump's and insufficiently connecting it to people's lives.
Yeah, and that's something that you did a great job of with the ads that you ran against Romney in 2012. Yeah. Do you think that that would have been a good playbook to go back to in 2016?
I do. Now, in defense of myself and my colleagues at our PAC, we tested it. It didn't seem to work as well.
Really?
Now, in hindsight, I say, I don't care. You know, but we're going to do it anyway. We had enough money. We could do both, to say the truth. I mean, we had $190 million. I mean, good Lord. So we could have done both anyway. And I think I was overly wedded to the research and the data, which said that people could never vote for a guy who bragged about assaulting women and insulted POWs and mocked disability and called the immigrants rapists. But I should have done it anyway. Mm-hmm. But the ads we ran against Romney never criticized his personal character because he's basically a man of very good character.
Right.
I don't agree with him on issues, but he's a good person. By the way, so was George H.W. Bush, who my boss Bill Clinton defeated. You know, Bush was a very good person, but we had different ideas. You couldn't get to that with Trump. You couldn't begin by saying, well, he's a good person. Yeah. He's a horrible person. But I should have gone beyond that and say he's a horrible person who's going to hurt you. Mm-hmm. Good Lord. In rural America, which we talked about, we've lost 112 rural hospitals, another this week in Georgia. People are dying before their time in our cities at the hands sometimes of cops, sometimes of COVID. In our suburbs, the same. In our rural areas. So we're not, my class, the professional class of Democrats, just didn't do a good enough job. And this time around, this is why I'm doing this book, is to tell people, here's how your life will be worse if Trump wins. Here's how it'll be better if Joe wins.
Now, for a number of reasons, though, 2020 is going to be a very different election than 2016, yeah. You know, among other reasons, because of COVID. So which of those lessons can still be applied this time around? And how much of 2020 is just going to have to be totally uncharted territory?
That's a great point, Ben. A lot, most of it. A couple of things. We've never, in our 100 years, had an election in the middle of a pandemic.
Yeah.
And this is just crushing. And it's hard to ask people to stand in line for hours and hours to go and vote. So we need people voting by mail. It is safe. It is honest. It is ethical. The entire state of Utah votes by mail, and it doesn't skew left, and it's not crooked. It's one of the most ethical places I've ever been. So that's the first thing. There's a second piece that's completely unprecedented. We have never had an incumbent president, as Lincoln says in Steven Spielberg's movie, clothed in massive power, who will, I believe, refuse to acknowledge defeat and refuse to leave the office. And so Democrats don't just have to win. They have to win so big that even Trump supporters will say, well, no, the game's over. We need to transfer power to Biden. So this is completely different. You're right. And I want to relitigate a little bit of 2016 because of what I got wrong. And now here's how to do it right. But we also have to recognize that COVID has changed everything. And politically, it's changed everything to Trump's detriment. Mm-hmm. Because those showbiz skills don't work against a virus. They work against Rosie O'Donnell. Great. He's attacking Rosie or whoever he's, you know, the women on The View. It's always women and black people.
Yeah, guys, by the way. Of course.
It's never you and me. I mean, I'm glad I got one hate tweet out of it. But mostly, it's women and people of color. So we've got to win by so much that he can't steal it.
So then how does Biden play COVID? Is it just enough for him to stay out of the way and let Trump continue to dig his own grave? Or does he need to do more than that? How does he handle that issue?
No, I am.
Without seeming like he's politicizing it as well.
Right. You know? I'm a kibitzer. I'm a second guesser. But I have to say, General Mellie Dillon, who's running that campaign, and Joe Biden himself, they're doing a terrific job. The late Lee Atwater used to love to quote Napoleon. And he said, never interrupt your opponent when he's destroying himself. Joe is following the Napoleonic code there. But he also is doing a very important pivot in these last 100 days. Biden is now telling us what he will do. Mm-hmm. Build back better is his economic slogan. And he's giving us specifics. He's given a major new speech now on racial reconciliation, something that terrific hunger for in this country. So it's necessary but insufficient to say Trump's back. Mm-hmm. You also, Joe's really got to make the case of what he is for, how our economy will be more prosperous, how our society will be more just, how our people will be more healthy. Because getting rid of Trump is going to be a great thing. But what are you going to do the next day?
Yeah.
It's not enough to just not be Trump. And so I do think he's doing a good job of fleshing out what he stands for, not just who he stands against.
Okay. So are you saying it's still the economy, stupid, in 2020?
It is still. The actual sign, Ben, said change versus more of the same, which applies today. Then it said it's economy, stupid. And then it said, and don't forget healthcare. Oh, by golly, we could put that same sign up in Biden's basement, and it would still apply.
We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll return with more when we come back in just a moment. You say in here that when it came to the economic stimulus packages and the bailouts for businesses, Republicans became socialist and Democrats pretty much became Republicans. Explain what you mean there.
Well, the Trump tax cut for corporate America was astonishing in its size. Mm-hmm. Over $2 trillion. And to put that into perspective, Barack Obama saved the entire global economy for $832 billion. So $800 billion he used to dig us out of the worst economic collapse since the Depression. Trump gets $2 trillion of our money, gives it to corporate America. Now, I'm not saying that the tax code didn't need to be modernized. I'm sure there's changes that need to be made. I'm not anti-corporate. I'm not anti-capitalism. But of all the crises America faced when Trump took office, corporate profits were not one of them. In fact, corporate profits were at a record high. And so, I have a thoughtful conversation about how to modernize the tax code. I'm all for it. But we have real crises. We have 48,000 people a year dying from opioids. A great many of them in Trump country, by the way. He should care about them, too. I do. I don't know that he does. We have, of course, a healthcare crisis. We have, as we've seen, a racial justice crisis. So there were a great many crises that we should have addressed. By the way, our infrastructure is falling apart. You can't drink the water in Flint, Michigan. So all of those things could have used $2 trillion and more. But instead, he targeted it to corporate America. I think Democrats need to put that on trial. And they need to say, even before the COVID crash, Mr. Trump and his party have a series of economic ideas that say when corporate America is doing better than ever, we're going to give them stuff. And when middle America is struggling, we're going to take away stuff. The $2 trillion he spent cutting taxes for corporate America, he wants to pay for by cutting $2 trillion from Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security. Democrats should make that case every day.
But I remember that during the Democratic primary, Bernie accused Biden of also trying to cut Social Security and Medicare. Does it make it kind of a difficult issue for him as well? Should Biden be prepared for Trump to try to flip that issue back on him?
He should. He should. And he should lean into it. What Bernie was talking about was that once in the 80s, Joe supported a freeze, a one-year freeze. And that operates as a cut. It does. 1 year, one time, 40 years ago. And it was not enacted. I don't think that should keep Joe from defending Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid from $2 trillion worth of cuts. In fact, it's more important than ever. I mean, a lot of people in the 80s, when we were first entering this era of colossal Republican deficits, a lot of people of goodwill were saying, well, we should try this or that, these radical approaches. You know, I worked for President Clinton, who balanced the budget without cutting Social Security. And you can do it. So I don't think Joe should be hesitant at all. Trump accused Hillary of wanting to cut Medicare, which was a total lie. He projects. I never even took freshman psych, so I'm not really qualified. But there is this phenomenon of projection. Mm-hmm. And Trump always accuses you of what he himself is guilty of.
Yes, which is exactly what sociopaths do. They say, I'm not cheating on you, honey. You're cheating on me. You know, they flip it on you. Exactly.
Right. And now that had some effect You remember the debate when Hillary so presciently said, you're going to be Putin's puppet. Putin wants you because you'll be his puppet.
Yeah.
And he said, no puppet, no puppet. You're a puppet. I mean, that's
greatest
sci-fi.
Line in any debate right there. Jesus.
But she was right. But we've now lived under this. We have seen it. His projection doesn't work anymore. And it particularly doesn't work against Joe Biden. I think Democrats, I stayed neutral in the primaries. Democrats were very wise to pick Joe because he's a healer and a unifier. Yeah. And I've known him over 30 years.
Yeah.
And his most important quality is empathy. Well, that's the quality we lack most today. So it's perfect.
Right. And I remember in 2016 and even thereafter, there were many Trump supporters and even some independents and Democrats who had this sort of nonchalant attitude about Trump and would say things like, you know, he's crazy, but at least it'll be interesting or we'll see what happens. Now that we've seen what happened, do you think voters are taking this a lot more seriously this time around?
I do. I think that's one of his gifts is he made elections and politics spectacle.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in a healthy, prosperous, stable, free, fair country, there's room for that. And that's what we were under Barack Obama. And now, though, we've seen the consequences, the real life consequences. And so the song and dance isn't so funny anymore, you know, and the shtick has run out. And our lives really are at risk. We all know people, I think, who've got COVID. We know people who've lost their jobs. This stuff is real now. And, you know, it's the thing I guess I'm in like Bartlett's for, saying politics is show business for ugly people. And of course, you're sitting right at the nexus of that in Hollywood. But it is more than that, though. It's the only sensible way for a free people to allocate their resources and their money and their power. And it's not just a sideshow.
I wonder what demographics within the Trump coalition, for lack of a better word, do you see as persuadable, low-hanging fruit in 2020?
Well, first, college-educated women, particularly college-educated white women, particularly college-educated white women in the suburbs. Barack Obama was a pretty good politician. He lost them by 3 points. And he won comfortably. But no Democrat ever carries college-educated whites. Okay, but the women he did a little better. President Obama only lost them by 3. Next election, Hillary won them by 7. That's remarkable. College-educated white women, Hillary wins by 7. Guess what? In the midterms we just had, Nancy Pelosi's candidates won them by 20. So you go from -3 to +20. Guess what? The latest polling, and I know polling is suspect, the latest polling, Joe Biden is winning them by 39. So when you go from -3 Obama to +39 under Joe, something's happening. This is a massive major realignment.
Yeah.
And Democrats should lean into that and push it.
Do you think that Joe has a shot at getting a good chunk of those white working class blue collar males?
Absolutely. I think he does because, you know, he's a guy from Scranton. He is Joe Lunchbucket. You know, he understands their lives and he feels their pain. You know, that was Mock Clinton for saying that, but Joe very much does too.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, and see, he understands not that we progressives, Democrats, shouldn't be judging them harshly. We should be loving them. We should be welcoming them. You know, we're not going to agree with them on every issue, but pay them the respect of listening. You know, my wife and I are celebrating our 31st wedding anniversary.
Oh, congratulations.
There's 3 little words that are key to a long relationship. And it's not, I love you. It is, I hear you.
Ah,
And those folks, I think with some justification, white working class men had a sense of Democrats that stopped listening to them. And I don't think that that's altogether wrong. It's not altogether fair, but it's there's some validity to that among some Democratic elites who just like to piss on these guys. So in their anger and resentment, and a lot of it's race, it is, they're kind of not happy about having a black president. There's no question about that, but not all of it. There were a lot of people who voted Barack Obama and then voted Donald Trump. Joe can bring them back, and I want to welcome them. I'm a Catholic, and I'm a Pope Francis Catholic. I want to seek out converts, not hunt down heretics. Right. I want everybody in the church. And so does Joe.
Big Ten. Yeah. Yeah. I'm diverging a little bit, but I want to go back to COVID because you said something interesting in this book. Donald Trump has tried to deflect from his abysmal handling of COVID by saying that it was really Barack Obama who dropped the ball and failed to prepare for all this. You say in here that's not the case at all. The Obama White House actually tried to warn the incoming president about the threat of a pandemic early on. Tell us more about that.
This is amazing. It's been underreported. There was a tabletop exercise called Crimson Contagion And these things are very professional. It was run by the National Security Council and the Homeland Security Department. During the transition, before Trump came into office, the nonpartisan professional national security people sat down with the incoming Trump people and did a tabletop exercise. What if a pandemic came into America? An airborne respiratory infection is what they picked because it's easily transmittable. It predicted almost perfectly what happened with COVID. And it warned them, you have to have massive PPE. You have to be willing to lock people down and shut down public places. You have to have ventilators available. You have to keep social distance, all the things. And they completely ignored it. Worse than that, Barack Obama retooled our response to pandemic because of Ebola. You know, there's a guy named Ron Klain, who was the Ebola czar, one of the heroes of this book. Ron was also Joe Biden's chief of staff. And so President Obama made him Ebola czar. We had four whole cases of Ebola in the entire country, four. And it's very contagious and absolutely deadly, very deadly. And yet they limited it. So what they did was Obama created a pandemic response unit in the National Security Council, right in the heart of the White House. Trump disbanded it. It was led by a rear admiral. It was not partisan. It wasn't a bunch of liberals. It was a bunch of professional people protecting us from pandemics. So Trump completely gutted that and eliminated it. Then he went to the CDC budget. This guy's running the biggest deficits in history. And there's a budget in CDC for pandemic prevention. And they were forward deployed in 30 countries. And he cut their budget by 80%. And one of the countries that pulled out of was China.
Wow.
So Trump, he didn't cause the virus. I know that.
Sure.
But the response was his responsibility in what he did and in what he failed to do. He is costing people their lives and their health. Mm-hmm. And he needs to be held to account for that.
Yeah. And you also give lie to another claim of Trump's. Trump, who claimed that he was going to drain the swamp, has actually apparently put 170 special interest lobbyists in positions of power within our federal government. Who are these people and what parts of the government are they affecting?
It's astonishing, Ben. I'm so glad you raised that. He has turned over our government to the special interest lobbyists. And in fact, they don't even need to hire lobbyists anymore because the lobbyists are running the departments, particularly in areas affecting the environment and worker safety. The Environmental Protection Agency is run by a former coal lobbyist. Well, gee, what do you think he is doing there? And this is how the Health and Human Services Secretary, Alex Azar, is a former executive in the health industry. All across the government, you have these special interest lobbyists who are running departments that are supposed to be serving the American people. Instead, they're serving their special interests. One of the worst is that Trump, through his lobbyist appointments, has gutted the worker protections for guys who work, and they're all guys who work on offshore oil rigs. You know, growing up where we did, my brother worked on one of those rigs. I worked in the warehouse, running forklifts and sending supplies out to the rigs. And that's a good job, but it's a very hard job. It's a very dangerous job. And, you know, you fly out there on helicopters and you work usually 14 days on and 7 off. And these guys are risking their lives. And Deepwater Horizon happened. And that platform blew up and 11 guys were killed. And I tell their stories in this book, each one by name. Because what Barack Obama did after that was put in worker protections and safety protections so that we don't lose another 11 guys in another explosion in the Gulf. And Trump repealed those. Now, how the hell can you sleep at night knowing? And by the way, I bet you most of those guys in those rigs probably vote for Trump. God bless them. Right. I want them live to vote for Trump. I don't want them to die. And it's just heartbreaking how these special interests, just to maximize profit. And again, I'm not a socialist. I'm all for profit. But it's not worth killing people over. And this guy has repealed environmental, health and safety, worker protections all the way across the government. And it's just disgraceful. And I don't pay enough attention to it. I did in the book. I did the research. And it's there for everybody to see.
Yeah, and I think that you say in here that Trump's EPA and his handling of global climate change, along with his remaking of the judiciary, are probably the two biggest issues that are bound to have long-term ramifications well after he's been vanquished from the White House. I wonder, this is something that constantly comes to my mind. In a presidency that has been so plagued with ineptitude at every level, How has he been so successful in getting his way on those two issues?
Well, because he's pushing on an open door in the Republican Party.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it is important that people recognize that Trump was 40 years in the making. You know, we've had a campaign in one party in this country against science, particularly climate science, but also environmental science, for 40 years. I'm old enough to remember when Republicans were saying things like cigarettes weren't addictive. You shouldn't believe the Surgeon General. Wow. Well, no wonder people don't believe Dr. Fauci. They've been fed this crap from the far right for decades. And it's not just Donald Trump. It's all the way to Limbaugh, Gingrich, all the way back. So the environmental destruction is so scary because there are places, and I document this in the book, places like where my mom grew up, the little lake in New Jersey she used to go to, which now you can't swim in it in the summer and you can't skate on it in the winter. In the summer, it's full of toxic algae, and in the winter, it doesn't freeze thick enough. The ice used to be 2 feet thick. My great-grandfather used to cut ice out of that very lake and sell it into New York City. He was an ice man.
Oh, really?
So we're so now, we're so far down the road on climate change that, get this, the Flat Earth Society issued a statement saying, we believe in climate science.
Oh, really? So, no kidding.
They did. Even the Flat Earth Society is ahead of Trump and the Republican Party. But and then on the judges, the same thing. People, Mitch McConnell and his crowd, who came to Washington long before Donald Trump, when Donald Trump was still a Democrat, probably, they have had an agenda to reshape the federal judiciary against voting rights, against worker safety, against environmental protection. And those guys, and all guys, some women, they're going to be on the bench for decades. And, you know, when Congressman Lewis passed, I went to pay respects. And the line was 2.5 hours long. What an honor. And it wound all the way around the Supreme Court building at the Capitol. Supreme Court's across the street from the Capitol. And
yeah,
the way we were routed,
pretty good distance.
We covered the entire block. And I looked up into that court, and I was looking in the windows to see if I could see Thief Justice Roberts, the man who gutted the Voting Rights Act, which is the law that John Lewis shed blood for on the Edmund Pettus Bridge. And I am so angry about that. And that is the lasting legacy. By the way, Trump didn't put Thief Justice Roberts in there.
Right. That was
it was the prior Republican president, George W. Bush. So this has been going on for a long time with the Republican Party. And the hostility to our planet and our health and also the hostility to our system of justice is going to take a long time to undo.
Well, since you brought up voting rights, I want to ask about that. Maybe it's just me, but it feels like we've turned a corner on this issue, not just because of COVID and the push for mail-in voting and online voting, but also thanks to Stacey Abrams. And to some extent, right. I think the Black Lives Matter movement has been successful in putting voting rights back in the spotlight. Do you think that you've got the wind at your back on this issue now?
I still worry a lot, Ben, a whole lot, because of this war. Because we've lost Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, which protects us, where local and state politicians used to have to go to the Justice Department before they could change the rules of the laws, before they could close polling precincts and polling places. Now they don't. And so you still have a real effort from the right to disenfranchise, particularly people of color, but also young people. Trump is waging a war against vote by mail. Vote by mail is perfectly honest, it's perfectly safe. People should use it. So I'm still terribly worried about this. I will say, as someone from the more moderate Bill Clinton wing of the party, I've been so impressed with the left. I've been so moved by the Black Lives Matter movement. And I've been woke and everybody else, but also by the way that they are responding. Trump is lying. These are peaceful protests. They're not violent. This is not young people blowing up the ROTC building on campus, the way we heard about in the 60s. These are young people, and some older, but like young people, and they're registering their sisters and brothers to vote. They're registering their neighbors to vote. They're registering their parents to vote. And the fact that they are expressing their anger through such a patriotic means is really powerful. Stacey Abrams, I have her movement in the book, because I think she's been terrifically important. And one of the things she says, particularly to young people, is if voting didn't matter, they wouldn't try to take it away from you.
Oh, that's great. That's a good line.
I love that. She's so bright.
Yeah.
She's wonderful.
Is it a little bit of a difficult needle to thread when you're trying to make voting as easy and accessible for every citizen, but you also have to protect our elections not from homegrown voter fraud, but from the threat of election interference from abroad? Are those two goals somewhat at odds?
They're tough. That's a really good point, Ben. In-person voter fraud almost never happens.
Right.
I have the exact number of the book. It's something like 6 or 7 zeros, 0.00000013% of ballots. It just never happened statistically. But we do have to be on guard for Russian or maybe even North Korean or Iranian or Chinese. We have a lot of enemies out there. Mm-hmm. All of them hate democracy. All of them want to disrupt American democracy. All of them want Trump because he's weak.
Right.
And in Putin's case, he's Putin's puppet. But believe me, Kim Jong-un does not want a strong, experienced, stable Joe Biden to go up against. He wants, you know, Trump. So I am worried about that. The way to guard against it is a lot of which Nancy Pelosi has passed and even gotten through the Senate. Paper
trail.
Another is a paper. So there's a paper trail. Another is people should bring their phones to the polling place. And if they see something, they should record it. If they see somebody harassing or intimidating voters, they should record that. Another thing, and I hope your listeners will ponder this. If you can, and it's safe, volunteer to be a poll worker. You know, those poll workers are the majority, over 50% are older than 60, and a large percentage are over 75. And they're great, and they're heroes, but they are particularly susceptible to COVID. And so, you know, your audience is younger. If they can, and I don't want anybody to risk their health, but if they're in a position where they can safely use PPE and volunteer a few hours as a poll worker, that will be terrific because that'll shorten the line. Mm-hmm. We have more people working the polls, more people can vote. You don't have to stand in line as long. The best solution is to vote by mail or to vote early if your state allows it. But the second best is volunteer to be a poll worker.
And I think that's a great segue into the way that you conclude your book by hearkening back to JFK's call to national service and suggesting that America needs to renew her commitment to these programs like Peace Corps and AmeriCorps. Before we go, I have to ask, at a time when most people are just trying to survive, what is the argument to be made for national service?
Well, as you know from having interviewed Stan McChrystal on this podcast, General McChrystal, I'm a great admirer of his and his commitment to national service, and I share that commitment. It's the most important thing we can do in a crisis. First off, because we need to address the crisis, and service can do that. We can deploy young people into COVID work. Actually, he's not young, but my roommate from college, Steve Domenico, I'll plug him. He's out on the Navajo Nation right now. He lives in Alexandria, Virginia. He got on a plane and went out to Arizona, and he's in the Navajo Nation helping Navajos, Native Americans, who are really hurt by COVID. He's a good guy. He has good values. Big Democrat. Worked in the Clinton administration. Worked in the Obama administration. So he's out there. We should get young people organized to do this. They could help in Native American and First American communities. They could help in rural America. They could help in our cities. They could help with greening up old buildings that need to be made more efficient. There's a million things they could be doing. And what I would like to see is take AmeriCorps, which now has 75,000 people, take it at least to 1 million, maybe 5 million, maybe 10 million. Wow. The need is there. You know, about half of the people under 30 are unemployed. I mean, unemployment rate is skyrocketing. So you create jobs for them serving America. The need is there, and the money has never been cheaper. And then they would, in my plan, get a stipend for community college, apprenticeship, job training, university, med school, whatever it is they want to apply that to. And I think that's better, frankly, than free college. They could get loan forgiveness if they have student debt, but they would earn it by serving our country. And what that would do is give them job skills, but it would also give them life experiences being with people who are different from them. Mm-hmm. You know, all my kids went to Jesuit High School in inner city DC, Gonzaga. Great school. Gonzaga requires service. And first in the neighborhood where they have a soup kitchen on campus. So they have to feed homeless people on campus. But as they get older, they have to go. Like one of my kids went to the Lower Ninth Ward in New Orleans, serving with other kids. Several of them went to the Dominican Republic. When you serve with people who are different from you, it's hard to hate people who are different from you. And so I think it would also stitch together our social fabric so that like my well-off white kids from the privileged suburbs, we'll get to know people who live a very different life and get to admire and appreciate them, and vice versa. So anyway, I think it's the single best thing we could do. Joe Biden's successor in the Senate, Chris Coons, has a bill that would do just that. It would expand America to 1 million people. Joe, I know you're listening. You got a lot of time on your hands, but please endorse Chris Coons' bill to expand America to 1 million young people. It will transform the face of this country.
Yeah, terrific idea. And what more perfect rejection of everything that Trump stands for than creating a culture of national service? That's perfect.
Right. You replace the culture of narcissism with a culture of national
exactly.
service.
Exactly. Well, again, the book is called You're Fired, The Perfect Guide to Beating Donald Trump. Paul Begala, thanks for talking with me.
Thanks so much. This is terrific. And always good to see a fellow Fort Bend County boy.
Thanks again to Paul Begala for coming on the show. Order his new book, You're Fired, The Perfect Guide to Beating Donald Trump, on Amazon, Audible, or wherever books are sold. Follow Paul on Twitter at Paul Begala and look for his frequent political analysis on CNN. If you enjoyed today's podcast, be sure to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts and rate and review us while you're there. 5-star ratings and detailed reviews are one of the best ways for new listeners to discover the show. You can also follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at KickAssNewsPod and recommend us to your friends on your social media. For more fun stuff, visit KickAssNews.com, and I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@KickAssNews.com. For now, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News.